is said to have been founded by Dardanus. And at least as far as the Romans are concerned, Dardanus came from Italy. And when we realize that, we realize that the Roman sense of past and future, their sense of history and destiny, is at the center of their sense of themselves. From Troy, at the time of its destruction, the aboriginal Roman hero would come, and that hero, of course, is Aeneas. And it is the image of Aeneas fleeing a burning Troy which is important for us to keep in mind, because it was always in the minds of the Romans. Aeneas fled Troy leading his son Ascanius by the hand. He fled Troy bearing on his shoulders his father, and his father in turn had in his arms the Lares, the Penates, the household gods. So that Aeneas carries on his shoulders the past and he leads by the hand the future. He is connected with a sense of both, as he is connected to a sense of his responsibility, not to himself alone as an individual, but to the community of which he is a part and, in fact, of which he is the leader, because when he flees Troy, he flees leading a community of refugees who, if we think of them in a particular Roman fashion, are the descendants of those who came, that is, following Dardanus from Italy, and are therefore going back whence they came when following Aeneas, they leave Troy and go by way of Carthage, ultimately to Italy, where Rome will ultimately be founded. The traditional date of Aeneas' flight is 1184, but it will be another four centuries and more until Rome will be founded, because history is never simple, and even the Roman sense of history and how it intersects myth is not simple. Aeneas, in bringing his group finally to the coast of Italy, hooks up, one might say, with the Latini, with the Latins, and merges the two groups together. And in fact, the Latin name is taken up by the Trojans, so that we don't think of Troia, we think of Latina as the area where the, or Latium is the proper term, of course, as the area where Aeneas' descendants make their home. Ascanius establishes a center of that home at Lavinium, and eventually at Alba Longa. And there is a succession of some 13 kings that follow thereafter and carry us, in Roman sense of its historical self, down to the 8th century. And we arrive with the 13th to a fellow by the name of Proca, who had two sons, Numitor and Amulius, as Livy, the Roman historian of the time of Augustus, tells us. To Numitor, because he was eldest, Livy writes, he bequeathed the ancient realm of the Silvian line. But force proved stronger than a father's wish or the respect due an elder. Father's wishes and respects due elders are important things Romans want us to remember, that we must always remember. And so the fact that this doesn't work at this point already tells us that things are not going to work out the way the breaker of such codes wants them to. Indeed, the younger brother Amulius drove his brother out and ruled instead. Moreover, he destroyed Numitor's male issue and deprived his daughter Rhea Silvia of the hope of children by the specious honor of appointing her a vestal. Note well Livy's tongue-in-cheek, the specious honor of appointing her a vestal. On the one hand, as we shall see, the vestal virgins are worthy of the utmost respect, and Livy would be the last to deny that. On the other hand, he well recognizes that under the right circumstances, that otherwise respectable and respect-worthy position can be abused rather than properly used, and that was the case here at the beginning of the Roman era. However, fate, providentia, tyche, and everything else, destiny, was obviously working in a direction that was contrary to the ambitions of the younger brother of Numitor, Amulius, the younger son of Proca. And so the vestal was ravished and produced twins. As the father of this doubtful issue, she named Mars, Livy writes, whether she believed it was so or whether a god's responsibility gave the fault decency. Constantly Livy questions what are the motives of his characters, and constantly he juxtaposes traditions with what he takes to be facts and wonders how fact-worthy the facts are and how traditional the traditions are. In any case, the priestess was manacled when her uncle found out and thrown into prison. The boys he ordered flung into the river providentially, and there you see is that important word. It's a Hellenistic word, touche, a Latin-Roman word, providentia, which becomes a leitmotif of Roman self-conception, that what happens, happens because we are the darlings of the gods, and because we are not only the children of history, but the children of destiny. We who are constantly aware of our past are constantly developing our future. Providentially, then, the Tiber had overflowed its banks into stagnant pools, and as all of you are familiar, the story of these two babes, Romulus and Remus, is that instead of being drowned in a flood, providentially, they were on an area in the river which was dry, and a floating basket carried them until the keeper of the king's herd, a fellow by the name of Faustulus, found them being licked by a wolf with the wolf's tongue. And note again Livy's comment. Faustulus, the story adds, carried them home to his wife Laurentia to rear. Some hold that Laurentia was called she-wolf by the shepherds because she was free of her body, hence the origin of the fabulous tale. The tradition that Romans would carry in their hearts of Romulus and Remus, the image of themselves as a community and as a civilization that to this day adorns public works in Rome, the tradition of Romulus and Remus suckled by a wolf is questioned by the first historian whose work we have in extensive remains, Livy, and he relates it to a rather different kind of idea. In any case, when Romulus and Remus, Livy tells us, had grown stalwart in body and spirit, they not only faced wild beasts, they attacked robbers loaded with booty, they distributed their takings among the shepherds. In short, they grew up as two shepherd boys, but who were different from the others, because destiny and their own internal organism made them different. There was something about them that set them apart. There's a royal personality that shines through even if you grow up among shepherds. And ultimately, of course, what happens, as Livy explains it to us, is that way leads on to way, and they are able to overthrow their great uncle, to destroy him and place back in power their grandfather Numitor. But after he has been placed in power, and the unanimous shout of approval from the entire multitude ratified the new king's title and authority, and note to that phrase, the Roman sense that someone rules through the unanimous shout of approval from the entire multitude, that one doesn't seize power for oneself, but one takes power as the representative of a community that sees one as representing its entire interests, that as things move from Numitor to the next generation, which is that of his grandsons Romulus and Remus, plans for expansion were interrupted by their hereditary curse, lust for rule. After all, their grandfather had been dispossessed of his proper place by his brother. We shouldn't be surprised, Livy tells us, given how history and destiny work together, and given the way bloodlines are bloodlines are bloodlines, because we Romans are Romans, but in the same sense, the bloodline of Romulus and Remus is of a particular sort. It shouldn't surprise us that they get into an argument as to which should give his name to the new city and rule it when it was built. And it also is typical that the means of making that decision is that they wait for auguries. Romulus took one hill, the Palatine, and Remus took the Aventine. And Remus, it is said, first saw six vultures flying over his head. So he assumed it should be he because he had the first vision. But then Romulus saw 12 vultures fly over his head. Well, Remus says, I saw it first. Romulus says, yes, but there were twice the number that I saw than those which you saw. And in the end, there is a struggle that breaks out. And in the broil, Remus was struck down. So strangely, when one considers that Livy is the first historian of the imperial period, the time of Augustus, and we will talk about him more at a later time, curiously, he puts forth before us that the founding of Rome, the city, in the wake of 330 years of pre-Roman tradition that led from Aeneas to the time of Romulus and Remus, that the founding of the city and its naming Rome after Romulus was marked by the killing of one of two twin brothers who had fought together to elevate their grandfather and themselves to a proper position of power, but then who struggled between themselves to assert the naming of the city. And so the problem of weighing one's own individual needs and one's own individual desires against the needs and desires of the community is really placed right up front by Livy as a problem which from the beginning of Roman history has had to be dealt with in different ways. There are indeed different ideas that one sees as part of Roman history and of Roman self-conception. Just as we shall later on see Virgil's looking backwards at the period when Aeneas arrives and the problems that that presents as far as the responsibility of Aeneas to do what he must do, whether he wants to for personal reasons or not, because he has a responsibility to the community around him and to the community that includes past and future, so we also observe that Rome will see in itself as it grows from the time of Romulus to the end of the Republic, even forward into the imperial period, that Rome sees itself in its growth as something happening not through aggression ever, not through trying to usurp the rights of others ever, but happening in a kind of organic manner or happening in a kind of defensive manner. That as Rome starts to look healthier and more powerful, so its neighbors become fretful and fearful and attack, and the Romans defeat their neighbors, and Rome expands thereby. And then the next band of neighbors in the next circle out become fearful of Rome, attack, and are defeated, and Rome wins, and so they expand. So the sense, you see, of continuous Roman growth is viewed by the Romans as something that happens in a kind of organic and always a kind of self-defensive kind of manner, and never as a matter of something that is aggressive or something that is unnatural. And that pattern is accompanied by a series of ideas that are essential to Roman self-conception, of which the first is that term pietas, piety, to which I alluded by implication in presenting to you very briefly the picture of Aeneas fleeing Troy. In fact, indeed, when one thinks of Aeneas, one realizes that his epithet, as it is given by Virgil, is Pius Aeneas. The defining characteristic of Aeneas is piety, by contrast with Odysseus in the Homeric literature, who is swift-witted, or Achilles, who is swift-footed, the two respective heroes of the Odyssey and the Iliad. Aeneas is pious. That's what defines him as a characteristic. And that is the model that he is intended to have for all Romans, piety. And piety means to be respectful of the gods. It means to be respectful of your elders. It means to be respectful of your peers and even of your children. It means to be in a properly respectful relationship with all those that are around one, all those that came before one, all those that will come after one, all those that are in the here and now, and all those that are up there and which affect one by the powers that they have. Pietas, of course, intersects, rather obviously, the concept of religio, that is to say, what we call religion, which has as its root L vowel G, lig, the root that means a binding. You see it in the word ligament that binds muscles to bones, or ligature that binds up a wound, or in some writing systems like Devanagari that you use for Sanskrit, binds different letters together to create two and three and four letter combinations, which are called ligatures. So religio is that which binds a community together in its relationship with that other realm, with the gods. And the Roman sense of pietas, above all, is to be constantly conscious of the ever-presence of the gods and to behave appropriately vis-a-vis the gods. And it is no surprise, then, that religion, that religio, is very important to the Romans. Indeed, the oldest inscription that we have available to us from Rome that is to be found in the old Roman Forum and that goes back to the 6th, 7th, perhaps even, tradition at least would take it there, to the 8th pre-Christian century, an inscription on a black stone, the lapis niger, the black stone, is an inscription in which, separating an area, a grove sacred to a goddess, from the rest of the city, we are warned that whosoever enters improperly this grove will be, and the word that is given, albeit in an earlier plural pre-Latin kind of form, sacer, That's the term from which we get our word sacred. S-A-C-E-R, sacer, is the term from which we get the word sacred. And it's a term which, for the Romans, is obviously a double-edged term. Because if the sacred is the realm of the gods, the sacer is the realm of the gods. And we hope and assume that, by and large, the gods are positively disposed towards us and help us. And so the term sacer is a term that connotes blessing. Obviously, it also can connote curse, and indeed, in the stone, the lapis niger, that we find at the old Roman Forum, it is a curse stone. Whosoever moves this boundary, it reads, be he and his cattle sacer, and that means to be pushed outside of the community. That means not to be protected by its laws. That means not to be part of its religion. That means not to be bound up by that which binds a community together. And being bound as a community is an essential idea to the Romans. Being bound by pietas, being bound by religio, being bound as a communitas, a community, the root of which word may be wall, that is, it implies defense, communitas, but the concept of which for the Romans is not simply negative, defending us from others, but positive. It's working together in an organized fashion, and in such an organized fashion, working together, being able to accomplish much more than we could as a series of individuals. And indeed, again, one thinks of Aeneas, by contrast with Achilles and Odysseus. Achilles is an individual par excellence. He's so individual that he is willing to have his fellow Achaeans, his fellow Greeks, suffer intensely and immensely so that they will beg him to come back into the battle against Troy because his ego has been hurt, because he's been insulted by Agamemnon. Odysseus sails to Troy leading a fleet of ships. He comes back alone. He survives alone. He's an individual. Aeneas, by contrast, with these two aboriginal Greek heroes, is a man of community. He is someone who bears the past and leads the future with him as he comes from Troy. He is constantly reminded that his obligations are not to his own wishes and desires, but to the community around him, the community of the past, and the community of the future, the most stunning and telling passages of which are found, as we shall later see in more detail, in Book 4 of Virgil's Aeneid, when Aeneas, as Virgil tells us, would very much have preferred to stick around with Dido, but is told by Mercury, the god Hermes, the messenger god, that you love crazy fellow, you can't do that. You have no choice. You must go towards your destiny because your destiny is to found Rome. And so the obligations of and the obligations to the community intersect that sense of being bound together by what we call religio, intersect that sense of pietas, which ties one in a proper relationship not only to the gods, but also to the community of present as well as of past as well as of future. And all of this is part and parcel of the Roman sense of constant history looking backwards and historicity looking forwards, and of destiny overall that they see as the backdrop to all that has been done, all that will be done, and all that they are supposed to be doing right now. So indeed, as I shall later on reemphasize, Virgil's Aeneas is not only a model in general terms for Romans of how to be, he is a model in specific terms for the number one fan, the number one audience that Virgil serves, and that is, of course, Augustus, the man who will have, in founding the empire, tell history that he had saved the Republic, that man whose ethos is all about serving the community, is all about religio, is all about pietas. And Virgil says to Augustus implicitly, be like Aeneas. Consider your obligations to past and future. Consider your obligations not to yourself, but to the Roman community around you. Obligations which are defined by that which binds the community together called religio. That which binds a community together called lex, law. When we think of Rome, we think above all of the development of its legal system. And indeed, the root of the Latin word law, lex, we spell it L-E-X, but if one declines that word further, one realizes its root is L-vowel G. It's leg, as the root of religion is L-vowel G, lig. It's that same term, the binding together. And as religion binds a community together in its relationship with the gods, so law binds a community together in its relationship among its constituent human parts. Lex from ligare, from holding together. Holding together as a community gives us Romans the ability to wear down others who, as a bunch of individuals, may be individually more talented than we are at war, or more skilled in any number of other ways, but who, because they come at us as individuals, will ultimately be defeated by us who function as a group that is conscious of its group sense. The Romans are conscious of the fact at various stages of their history that when they go up, for example, against the Gauls, that the Gauls may be extremely fierce fighters, that the Germans may be man for man better warriors than we Romans are, that they bring their women to the war, Tacitus later on will write, and they yell and scream and inspire their men, but the fact is we Romans, functioning in units, functioning as a group, functioning as a communitas on the battlefield as back home, can overcome those who are individually perhaps superior to what we are. And the Roman sense of law is rather obvious. It's not just general and vague, but one moves through a succession of laws and law changes and legal systems as one moves through Roman history. From the Valerian law that offers to Roman citizens the right to appeal decisions before the assembly, there's that idea that we see in seed form in Livy's statement about Numitor, that the acclamation of the people made him the legitimate ruler after the overthrow and defeat and destruction, rather, of his brother, that the 12 tables set forth a whole series of laws, that Canulian law later on will make it possible for members of upper and lower crust families to marry each other, which is significant, and we will talk about all of these in greater detail later on, because it also suggests to us that the Roman legalistic and pietistic and religious sense of community is not stagnant. It's an evolution. And one of the Roman characteristics which is so useful to them and so responsible for their success is the way these basic principles of Roman ethos have a certain amount of adaptability, just as they have a constancy upon which one can constantly count, as one counts on things constantly which have constancy. One sees that adaptability in the way from the beginning, when Aeneas arrives with the Trojans to Italy, the Trojans end up merging together with the Latins, and in fact go so far as to allow the Latin name to become the name of the area that they inhabit, Latium. They don't make it New Troy or something of that sort. One sees that in the growth and development of the res romana, the Roman thing, as it moves forward down towards the time of Romulus and Remus, and even more so as it moves forward from Romulus and Remus and other groups and other peoples come within the res romana, that they are not necessarily, even if in some cases they might be initially, enslaved, subjugated, but rather the Romans will evolve concepts of citizenship that will make it possible and desirable for diverse groups to want to become part of the res romana. And so Roman growth, which is organic, which is self-viewed as inevitably natural and defensive rather than aggressive and unnatural, will also include not only the propagation of Roman religious and legal concepts and the propagation of the idea of pietas, and the propagation of the idea of history and destiny, but also the propagation of the possibility of different groups becoming part of the Roman thing and not being treated separately. Nowhere will that become more apparent than looking well into the future, when we will get to the 2nd century AD, when amongst the most important Roman emperors, Trajan, Hadrian, and so on, are figures who not only are not Roman, they're not even Italian, in fact they come from Spain, which will tell us when we get there that that sense of inclusionary rather than exclusionary thinking where citizenship enfranchisement is concerned literally extends from one end of the empire to the other. It includes the possibility of someone from a rather distant province ultimately becoming the emperor of Rome itself. This is, of course, far into the future. But the concepts are already being planted in the Roman self-conception distantly into the past. And one sees, as far as the development of Roman legal and political terminology, how really from early on this is apparent. It seems that the early Latin tribal confederations, and we have really a fairly vague rather than a very specific sense of them, amongst which the Romans moved and with whom the Romans became involved, that they functioned as far as leadership is concerned along a number of different kinds of lines, that there were some, or rather each Latin city had some sort of leader or group of leaders. Some had a leader that was essentially a king. The Roman word is rex for that, and that's a term, for reasons that we will later on see, that the Romans would come to abhor. But the annual election of a king in some Latin cities gave to that individual a particular term, the term being dictator. Now, that word has come to have a very different meaning for us in English, but a dictator is someone who speaks. It's a speaker. A speaker of the house can be a dictator or a dictator. And that's one form of leadership that the Romans countenanced and wove into the fabric of their developing political and legal system. Another form was to have a group of chief magistrates, magistrates who were called aediles, A-E-D-I-L-E-S, interestingly and appropriately, coming from the word aedes, A-E-D-E-S, which is one of the Roman words for temple, so it implies a religious aspect to it. Another form of leadership, dual chief magistrates, was the praetor form of leadership. And one sees over the course of the first few centuries of Roman history that these different terms appear and that clearly they were woven in different ways into the fabric of the Roman political and legal system. It was the primary responsibility, of course, of such leaders to define, and even more than to define, because that became, in the broadest sense, the responsibility of the people at large, but to administer the leges, that is to say, the laws, the purpose and point of which, having been defined by consensus and agreement amongst the people or its assembled leaders, the point and purpose of which was to maintain a stability to the fabric of peoplehood. And it was their responsibility as well to administer the religio, that is to say, the religion that bound the community together in its relationship with the gods. And in fact, there is one term from the early Roman period that survives that suggests the importance of religio and understanding it as simultaneously connected to and yet separate from lex, the responsibility for dealing with those powers related to but separate from the responsibility for dealing with those around us within the community and those beyond the borders of the community. And that term, that particular term, rex sacrorum, which has survived, which is to say king of the sacred things, is the term that suggests this specific distinction for us. The Roman sense of the sacer, which we find in that term, which connects to that first inscription on the lapis niger, which is at the root and heart of their sense of religio and their sense of pietas, is a concept, to repeat, that is double-edged. The powers of the sacer can give blessing or curse. They can make it rain when we need it for the crops, or they can drown us in a flood, or they can withhold rain and leave us with drought. That's conveyed by the sense of that of sacer that one finds on that inscription when one traces where it takes us and what it means. Someone who is sacer, to repeat, is someone who in Roman terms is outside the profanos, which is its opposite. Profanos, a term from which we get the word profane, is a term which means to be within the communitas, within the community. To repeat, someone who is sacer is outside the community. Well, in some sense, the gods are beyond the community. But in a different sense, if I have inadvertently upset that stone, the lapis niger, which is what the inscription says, whosoever moves this, I will be Sakir. I'll be outside the community. I'm no longer protected by its laws. Anyone who wants to can harm me. I'm no longer part of its relationship with the gods, its religio. And so I go out into that outer realm of the wilderness, which is also the Sakir. It's beyond the community. It's beyond the profanos. And in that reality, what could happen to me is positive or negative. I could be destroyed by wolves. I could be robbed blind by brigands. In a different context, my fairy godmother might tap me on the shoulder, give me three wishes, and make my life as wonderful can be. That's the double-edged possibility of the Sakir. But I don't want to be part of the Sakir. I really want to be part of the profanos. I want to be part of the community. How can I come back into the community? And why is it that I was pushed out of the community in the first place? The answer to these questions explain a good deal to us about the Roman sense of itself, of themselves, as a community. Why, first of all, am I out into the Sakir if I upset that boundary marker? Because every boundary and every boundary marker is symbolically and analogically the same as the ultimate boundary between the profanos, by which I mean in this case not only my community, but the community of the world with which I am familiar, and the Sakir, by which I mean not everything just outside my community, the realm of the familiar, but the ultimate Sakir, the realm of divinity, which can act positively or negatively towards me. If I upset a boundary marker, I upset that boundary. And in upsetting that boundary, I might disturb those powers. And in disturbing those powers, I might bring the anger of some of them on, well, that's the point, not on me. But as long as I'm part of a community, I might bring it onto the whole community, which is why I must be pushed out of the community so that that curse I will bear on my own shoulders. This is not an idea which is unique to the Romans. The terminology is important because it's the terminology that over the centuries has become our own. The concept of the individual having to leave the community lest the curse that comes on him should come on it, we find not far from Rome when we turn to Greece and consider Oedipus, for example, who, as it turns out, has offended the gods unwittingly because he killed his father and married his mother, and therefore brought plague on Thebes, therefore had to leave Thebes so as to carry the curse with him. So then the next question is, what do I do to offset that? What do I do to assuage the powers I may have offended so that I can come back into the profanos? And it's clear that what I must do is give some offering to those powers. Make something Sakir in my stead. And so I take a goat, or I take a cow, or I take a bull, or I take an ox, or I take a sheep, or whatever it is, and I offer it to the gods as a kind of gift, and in so doing, I make that goat or sheep or cow or ox or bull, instead of me, I make it Sakir. Now, those of you who are Latin scholars know that the word to make or do in Latin is facere. So to make something Sakir is Sakir facere. Obviously, this process happened frequently enough that the two words ended up together, and from Sakir and Fakire, we got Sakir Fakire, Sakificare, Sacrificare, which is, of course, the word that we receive as sacrifice. To sacrifice is to make Sakir. So the Roman who has upset the lapis niger, who has inadvertently, perhaps, upset a boundary marker, which because of its symbolism of the relationship between profanos and Sakir in the biggest sense, wreaks potentially havoc because of disturbing what is on the other side of that boundary, the powers of the Sakir. And because, in particular, of the Roman emphasis on community, brings with it a particular concern that the community will be harmed by the disturbing of that boundary, and not just the individual. That individual, having gone out into the Sakir, away from the profanos, away from the community, can come back into the profanos by sacrificare, by sacrificing, by making something else Sakir in his or her stead. And we observe two things about that process of sacrificare. The first is that I can't just offer it anywhere, anytime, anyhow. On the contrary, with absolutely precise procedure, I offer the bull or the ox or the cow or the goat or the sheep in a specified place, which is understood to be a place that connects to those powers, a sakir place, an ides, a templum, and I do so at a specific time. Perhaps it's at sunrise, perhaps it's at high noon, perhaps it's at sundown, perhaps it's at midnight, at a time perhaps when realms meet, when night and day meet, when the sun is precisely at its zenith, when the sun is precisely at the horizon coming up or going down, when we are exactly in the middle of the night, a precise time in a precise place according to a precise procedure. How do I know time, place, and procedure? Because there is an individual whom we call a priest, who would be called in Latin a sacerdos, a giver of the sacer, who knows, for whatever reason such an individual knows in every tradition, and not only the Roman has such individuals, who, because of a connection which you and I don't have with the sacer, intermediates between profanos and sacer and has the information, has the knowledge of where and when and how. So that rite and ritual and the terminology of rite and ritual that we use in our own languages connect back to the Roman Latin terminology that connects to the inscription on the lapis niger, the term sacer, and everything that flows therefrom. By the way, because I said there were two things that we note about this process of making something else sacer. By the way, the second thing, of course, is that the condition of that animal that I make sacer is a double-edged condition, is it not? On the one hand, I have transferred the curse from my shoulders to it, so it is cursed. But on the other hand, if it is being offered to the powers of the sacer, and essentially I understand the gods, the powers of the sacer, to be positive, then surely it is blessed to be offered to them. That contradictory nature of the sacer is reflected in the contradictory nature of the moment of making something sacer, of sacrificare. And if that seems strange to you, consider what we shall later on as a very important development in Roman history, and that is the transition of Rome from being a pagan to becoming a Christian society, and what stands at the center of that transformation. The figure of Jesus, who to Christians is, on the one hand, as cursed can be, at the moment of sacrifice, of sacrificare, he bears on his shoulders the sins of humanity, who is simultaneously, in initiating the long moment in time out of time of sacrificare that leads from passion to crucifixion to resurrection, returning to the realm of God the Father, that is to say, as blessed can be. So he is simultaneously cursed and blessed, who is sacrificed as the goat or the bull or the ox or the sheep, that the fellow who has kicked over the lapis niger, endangered the community, gone out into the sacer, offers at precisely the right time, at precisely the right place, according to precisely the right kind of ritual and rite, so as to come back into the profanos. The terminology of relationship to the sacer is the foundation of the terminology of Roman pietas, the terminology of Roman religio, and the self-conception that connects religio as what binds us to the gods, to lex, which binds us to each other and is connected with us and through us to the history that carries us back to our beginnings, which for the Romans is Aeneas coming from Troy, or perhaps one might say even further back, Dardanus coming from Italy in the first place to found Troy, and leads to us from those beginnings, layered to different time point beginnings, Dardanus viewed through one set of spectacles, Aeneas through a second, Romulus through a third, and as we shall see, the founding of the Republic, yet a fourth pair of spectacles, leads to us and then out towards the future, because Roman self-conception sees us at all times as we build on the past, building towards the future. This self-conception, as one sees it, in the development of a political system, that is increasingly complicated as Rome grows and absorbs non-Romans, non-Latins, eventually non-Italians, and makes of them all part of the res romana, the Roman thing. And as one sees it in the expanding legal system that carries us from Valerian law to 12 tables to Canulian law, that carries us from rex and dictator and aediles and praetors and rex sacrorum to a whole range of different terms that identify different individuals and groups who have as their responsibility to intermediate amongst the community, within the community, to intermediate between the community and the outside world, to intermediate between the community and the powers which make us Romans not only the children of history, but the darlings of destiny. And all of that we see also expressed, and again, this is not unique to the Romans, but no one did it better than the Romans did, expressed in Roman literature and in Roman art, which again and again states and restates what we Romans are, where we Romans have come from, where we Romans are going, what we Romans are all about. This is, again, not unique to Rome. It's just particularly well done by the Romans, that what we are politically, whether it is I, Romulus, the founder of the state, or whether it is I, Augustus, who claim to have saved the Republic, but who most historians would view as the nailer of the last nails into the coffin of the Republic and the founder of the empire, or whether I am Constantine, who changes the complexion, spiritually speaking, of the empire, or begins that change, that in all cases, each of these individuals and others like them, of course, will justify the political condition of which they are part and which they impose on the world around them in religious terms, in spiritual terms, by reference to the Sacer, by reference to the divinities who guide us from past to future. And the expression of that political righteousness, justified spiritually and religiously, lex created by religio, religio with pietas at its foundation, will be expressed in the literature of Rome that talks, as Virgil does, of an Aeneas who is an Augustus and an Aeneas who is a model for us all. It will be expressed, also eventually questioned, by other forms of literature that see through the empty statements which such questioning literature will say has no substantial backup to the statement. And it will be seen in Roman art, architectural and sculptural forms, which state and restate where we've come from and where we are going. The Roman arch, as we shall see, which established here and established there and established there, become not only markers of the order which we Romans have imposed upon the world, which has become a synonym with Rome, world equals Rome, Rome equals world, but each arch decorated with the words and the images that state how we got here and what we have accomplished, and with each arch and with each column that is historiated with the account of what I, Trajan, or what I, Marcus Aurelius, have accomplished, and with each structure that is contrived, like the marvelous altar of peace, the Areopagus of Augustus, each such work will tell contemporaries of the Romans and us, the descendants of those contemporaries, who they are, where they came from, what principles they uphold or claim to uphold, pietas, communitas, religio, lex, an ordering of the world, of course, for its betterment. The process of which ordering for betterment or not, we shall continue to explore next.